Welcome to the Supertone Show. The show's co-hosted by Simon Camel.
That's me.
His hair's growing ever long every day. And myself, Susie Starlight. And we run a vintage residential recording studio in Estevella, Valencia, Spain.
We do.
Now, he's an English record producer, arranger, composer, conductor, audio engineer and musician. His career has spanned more than six decades of work in music, film, television and live performance. He clocked up 30 UK number one hits and 23 in the USA.
That's not me.
He elevated the art of album making.
Did he?
And not only was he one of pop's greatest producers, but unquestionably its greatest gentleman, Sir George Martin.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. You feel for a golden girl knows when he's kissed her. It's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He
Goldfinger by Dame Shirley Bassey.
I can't. The only thing I think about when I think about that is the Austin Powers film Goldmember, which, anyway, let's not go into the Goldmember. We're talking about George Martin today. That, of course, we had to start the show with that that track. Everybody thinks about George Martin and they think about the Beatles, but what we've tried to do in this show is, there are some Beatles tracks in here, but yeah, we've tried really to focus on more of his other stuff. And that is one of his more magnificent productions. Of course, he didn't actually direct the orchestra or the actual arrangement of that, because John Barry, who wrote the track, he came in and arranged it. So George Martin was sort of a pseudo producer, but anyway, you know, he is credited as the producer of this record.
Fantastic.
And she, of course, is magnificent as ever.
I mean, as ever.
Who can not love Shirley Bassey? I mean, she's been a stalwart of British music for, it seems like, centuries, you know? She's still alive, isn't she?
Thank God.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm glad we don't want to kill her off. Not at this stage, anyway. Shirley, we love you. Of course, George has now passed away. Sir George has passed away. But there's a very interesting little anecdote about that track, because apparently the last note was troublesome. Mm-hmm. Now, bearing in mind, they had this full fucking orchestra in there. But, of course, it's a Bond theme, so I suspect money wasn't too much of a problem in the recording of it. But for the last note, what she had to do, she slipped behind one of the acoustic screens in the studio and took off a bra and then came...
No way.
Yes, so she could get the last note. If we're gold, all that stuff, yeah. So she apparently she felt a bit restricted, so she whipped off her old bra, and that was it.
Freedom and liberation, go girl.
Well, that's it, you know. So you can't argue with old Dame Shirley for that. Brilliant work, brilliant work.
I can't speak. I'm just picturing it now.
Yeah, well...
Sorry,
yeah.
Darlings. Just carry on. Let's start again.
The other interesting thing about this as well is that I think playing guitar, well, you can't really hear it, was Big Jim Sullivan and Jimmy Page.
Both of them?
Yeah, two of our favourite players, you know?
No way.
So old Big Jim was in there giving it some stuff and...
What was Jimmy Page doing in there?
Oh, I don't know. But he was a session guitar player.
I know,
player.
I'm joking.
Oh, yeah, he was a bit dazed and confused. Oh, ba-bum, psh. For those Led Zeppelin fans, of course.
So I did a little bit of background research with George. As you would do. Just to kind of get a sense of what it was like for him growing up and to see if I could feel any kind of influences that you could see later on in his career. His parents got a piano in the house when he was six. He started playing piano, but he had to stop his lessons. His mum had a bit of an argument with the teacher. So that,
I wonder why that was.
Yeah, and that went boobies up.
So, tits up! Oh!
See?
More boobie jokes see? After the...
So I think he had...
After Dame Shirley.
I know, I'm not going to talk about that. But he had, I think... he was really into sort of Glenn Miller, the music of his era, really. He led his own band. He joined up in the Navy and...
But he was in the Fleet Air Arm, wasn't he?
He was an aerial observer.
Blimey.
And he was friends with the guy at the Guildhall School of Music who persuaded him to go and study piano and oboe at the Guildhall for 3 years.
I love oboe.
Yeah.
I love oboe, mellotron. It's got that...
Reedy sound, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love oboe.
There's history. History in the oboe, like the French horn.
Oh, I knew the freaking French horn would come up again. Because yes, did you used to play the French horn, darling?
Si.
Yes. Who else used to play the French horn? John Entwistle. Oh, yes, we know about that as well. And you're a bass player. Oh, right, okay. So if you listen back over the past 8 shows, we always bring this up. It's okay.
It's no all right, though. It's a beautiful instrument.
It is.
The curves of that instrument are quite beautiful.
Yes. After the boobies and Dame Shirley and curves. Come on.
Anyway, so basically what happened is that when he left Guildhall, I think he worked for the BBC Classical Department for a short time and then joined EMI and worked for Oscar Prius, who was the label manager for Parlophone.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I think at that point, let's hear another song. Thank you. Because we ended as lovers. Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck.
Well, it's not. It's Jeff Beck. It ripped by Stevie Wonder. Oh, ho, ho.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a cover. And the next track, Thelonious, which I think is another Stevie Wonder song, Stevie Wonder played, I think he played clavinet on it, but he was never credited on the record.
Why is that?
I don't think he wanted to.
Okay.
I don't know.
I quite like the idea of Franz just dropping in and doing a little session playing and then...
Well, when you're Jeff Beck and when you're Stevie Wonder and he wrote it, I suppose he can do what the fucking hell he wants.
Yeah, indeed.
you know, so it's amazing. But when I think about that song, I always think about the magnificent performance he did at Ronnie Scott's. It's on DVD, you can buy it. I would urge you, if you're a guitar player or even a music fan of any type, really, if you listen to it, it's an amazing record. It's got Vinnie Colucci, who's my favourite drummer of all time, obviously on drums, and Tal Wilkenfeld, a very young Tal Wilkenfeld, bass. And she does an exquisite solo in this. And really, the track we should have played is the one that has inspired many guitar players. What's that one called? Is it Diamond?
Diamond Dust.
Yeah.
Well, they say, yeah, that future guitar heroes like Joe Satriani owe their entire careers to that piece, really, for inspiration.
Yeah. But I mean, but Beck was doing something quite different then, because this was a really big instrumental album, wasn't it?
Well, it was. They recorded it sort of late 1974, and this was 5 years after George Martin stopped working with
the Beatles. Go on.
The band,
yes.
The other band,
yes.
And it was the first instrumental record to ever break into the top 10. It reached number 4.
Wow!
And Jeff's first step into recording albums without vocals.
Well, of course, he did. I think he did one himself with vocals, i.e. Hi Ho Silver Lining, his first and only venture into into vocals, which I remember listening to in every college disco when I was a young man. And when you're all pissed up, you're like, Hi Ho Silver Lining, but it's a fucking awful song. It must have made him a load of money, but
it's really weird because I've seen the Ronnie Scott's video and I've got to hear more of Jeff Beck in the last few years, but I didn't realise that was him. I know the song from my youth,
of course,
but I didn't know that was Jeff Beck.
Well, no, he didn't own up to it,
because all I remember is Top of the Pops and some guy in some, I think he had a white outfit on or something, and just, you know, the normal Top of the Pops atmosphere.
Undoubtedly.
No way, that was Jeff Beck.
Fred, so, yeah. And of course, the thing is with Jeff, just a little bit more about Jeff, because we love him here.
Absolutely.
The Jeff Beck group originally had Rod Stewart as lead vocals. And Jeff Beck was always really pissed off with Jimmy Page, because Jimmy Page, of course, formed Led Zeppelin. Jeff Beck formed the Jeff Beck group. Page had Plant. And old Jeff had Rod Stewart. But it all fell to pieces for one reason or another. Obviously, Zeppelin had lots of very strong material and it went from there. But anyway, there we are. But back to George Martin anyway.
Indeed. So I think George Martin was saying that he was really surprised when Jeff approached him about producing this album. Mm. But he said that Jeff was saying it's really nice to work with somebody that knows a G flat from an A minor. And he said that George is really good, a very objective person to be around, and he put everything into perspective because as a producer he was saying, and he controlled it, any wild ideas he had, you know, he'd push them out a window if he didn't think they'd work. But I don't think either of them really totally understood what they were doing either.
Well, yeah,
they were experimenting.
Yeah, but you see, if you think about it, it's logical because Sir George was all about instrumentals. I mean, he was known for his magnificent string, brass and orchestral arrangements all the way going back, to when he first started.
Yeah.
And I suppose this just being the first instrumental album, it kind of makes sense, if you know what I mean.
Well, they were saying that the idea of putting strings behind his playing was a fairly radical one, like on Scatterbrain and Diamond Dust. So when George sort of said, let's put some strings on this, and there's a recurring theme here as well, because George is the string arranger.
Well, he is,
and he's big on strings, isn't he?
And I can't remember who that producer was who put strings on The Thrillers Gone by B.B. King, and he was the first person ever to put strings on a blues song, and his name escapes me at the moment, but we might find out later on the show. We might have a quick Google.
We're going to have to find out now, otherwise we won't be able to sleep.
We won't sleep, we will not sleep.
See? So I think that's what a beautiful combination. So you've got George Martin, Jeff Beck. But what happened as well after this album, when it really just shot off and it was hugely successful, of course it put an immense amount of pressure for the second album.
Mm.
And I don't think they enjoyed the process as much because...
No, it got it got slated quite a bit, actually, because...
I was really worried.
Yeah, and the next one was called Wired. That was also produced by George Martin. And but, I mean, off that one, there's a track called Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, which, again, is a cover. As you all know, you jazzers will know. Yeah. And that's a great song, and it's really well played and well performed. But, you know, it's like anything else. You know, he had a massive success, and all of a sudden the pressure's on, isn't it?
Well, from the record company. You do find that, though. I mean, and it's really difficult because you do your best. And I know this from talking to other professional musicians and people who've had these major hits in countries that, you know, are now got double the burden because they don't know how they're going to follow it up. Mm. How do you beat that? And the thing is... You can't. All you have to do is just keep being you and keep being true to what you do, because you can't control if an audience connects with you and how it connects with you.
Absolutely.
That's totally out of your control. It must be a complete, like a mixed bag of fantastic, euphoric nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way.
Yeah. Well, you know, George Martin as well is not only about... his production, but also his engineers. And the engineers on these Jeff Beck records were not his normal guys. It wasn't Jeff Emmerich, who's been working with him in the Beatles and everything, who's done an awful lot of stuff. Anyway, let's move on to the next track, shall we?
Okay. What is it?
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
The Beatles and Yesterday. It was one of the first songs I learned on acoustic guitar.
Is that right?
It's what taught me how to play an F.
Blimey.
Because it was really difficult and I was desperate to learn it because it's such a beautiful song.
F's are always difficult.
It was, what's my first bar chord? It was really, I worked on it for ages.
Yeah, at the bottom
it
of the
hurt.
Neck. It is. It always hurt.
Did you know that that the working title, well, that song actually came to Paul McCartney in a dream.
It came in a dream.
I had a dream. I woke up in the morning and it had for ages a working title, and it was called Scrambled Eggs.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right,
okay. He worked on it for ages.
Good job it probably wasn't ended up called Scrambled Eggs, actually.
Yeah, something about The Way I Love Your Legs or something. I mean, it was just, he hadn't put the words to it, but I think Paul was going around asking people, have you heard this tune before? Because he was worried that he'd kind of stolen it.
You can That's a nice thing to hear of Paul McCartney.
Yeah,
it?
It's like, have you heard this song before? And apparently George said no, and he asked a load of people.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so what a fantastic song.
Well, it is.
With a great story.
Yeah. I mean, well, it is legendary, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can't say it's greater than great. But the interesting thing about the recording side of it is that, of course, Paul McCartney played that using an Epiphone Texan, was it? Steel string?
Yeah.
And he played and sang at the same time, which, of course, you'll get bleed from both mics. But, of course, they didn't care. Jeff Emery didn't care what was going on with that. He just recorded it, you know? It doesn't actually matter. And, you know, one of the greatest, probably most covered and probably most played songs of all time had lots of bleed on it, folks. Yeah! And the string quartet.
Indeed, and it was George's idea to put a string quartet on it.
Yeah.
And apparently Paul said, "I don't want Mantovani."
Well, if you don't know who Mantovani is, he was like a really dodgy, cheesy string arranger and he did all these big string records. Yeah, I know what you mean.
So you can imagine, obviously. He said, "Oh, no, I'll put strings on it." "No, I don't want Mantovani." He said, "No." Basically, he said, and this is him quoted from an interview as well. This is George Martin saying, "You know, we can be more clinical than that. We'll use a Baroque string quartet," which is basically a classical form of two violins, a viola and a cello.
Mm.
Yeah. And when they were recording the quartet, these musicians, they didn't want to have headphones. So he put the vocals and guitar through two speakers.
No.
Next to the quartet. So you've got the bleed again into the string track.
Holy shit.
So the whole song has got bleed everywhere.
Now, you see, you would never think that.
No.
Because... Well, I'm going to have to listen to it again after this now. I'll get it on the old ATCs and whack it up and have a good listen. But, you know, I think it just goes to prove that a lot of this stuff that people talk about recording, it's complete bullshit. Total bullshit. Lanois, bloody Tom Dowd, who we're going to be speaking about in a couple of weeks' time, the mighty Glyn Johns, Andy Johns, all these guys, they all... embrace bleed. They're more interested in the performance, and that is what George Martin got here. He got a great performance out of Paul McCartney, you know, singing and playing at the same time. He got a great performance out of the string section because they didn't want to use headphones, so he said, "Well, we're not going to fucking use headphones. We'll just stick some speakers right next to the, you know."
Yeah.
Incredible.
It is, and this song has been covered over 2,200 times already, and it was voted best song of the 20th century in a Radio 2 poll in 1999.
Yeah, well, that's...
It goes on. It's ridiculous. It's like one of the fourth most successful songs of all times, grossing £19.5 million.
Yeah. Well, you know...
But it shows up that the human side of our nature connects. That's the thing.
Yeah. And he got it in a dream.
Yeah.
Rather like Rupert Neve. He came up with his design for his EQ circuit in a dream. And he got it one morning and wrote it. I was very lucky to have a long chat with Rupert over some coffees and stuff. And he was a great guy. But it's quite frightening when you know somebody comes up to you and says, "Well, you know, one of the most important EQ circuits ever been designed and one of the greatest songs ever been written came to them in a dream." So I think we should sleep more.
I was just thinking that and have like a notebook by, you know, just not talk to each other in the morning and just write down everything, you know.
Now for something completely different.
Life goes on day after day. Hearts torn in every way. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay. People, they rush everywhere, each with their own secret care. So ferry across the Mersey and always take me there, the place I love. Around every corner, they seem to smile and say,
We don't care what your name is, boy, we'll never turn you away. So I'll continue to say, here I always will stay. So ferry cross the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay, and here I'll stay, here I'll stay.
Ferry cross the Mersey, Jerry and the Pacemakers, classic.
Yeah, Jerry Marsden. That's Jerry. Wouldn't sound quite right if he was called Jerry Marsden, would he? It's Jerry and the Pacemakers. And of course, pacemaker later on had a completely new
exactly
meaning.
Exactly, I was
going
to say. It sounds like a retired citizen badge.
Indeed, it does. Yeah, but I mean, we may laugh, but that was a monster fucking hit, absolutely monster. And of course, it's had many reincarnations following the Hillsborough disaster. Of course, that was like the big song that sort of supported the whole thing. I think it was a charity single. It was re-released, magnificent. But of course, before that, he also wrote "You'll Never Walk Alone," didn't he?
Yeah.
And George Martin produced that.
And he put strings. It was the first time he'd put strings with them on that track. And right. Then he worked on Yesterday.
Oh, right.
Which
okay.
Is
yeah. So he had previous.
Yes, he had previous string convictions.
Incredible. But you know, it's obviously it makes such a massive difference when you hear strings. You know, in a track, it really gives it some class and depth. And sometimes I think it can be a bit cheesy, but any of the stuff that George Martin did wasn't cheesy, you know? I mean, he had a right go at Phil Spector when he did The Long and Winding Road, because with all those fucking choirs on there and strings.
Well, you say engineered by George Martin, his suggestion, overproduced by
overproduced by Phil Spector, yeah.
I think that was the closest he'd ever come to saying a nasty comment in his life.
Yeah, he was a real gentleman.
He was, by all accounts.
Yeah. And a joker, because early on in his career, he did a lot of comedy, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. He started off because Parlophone was like an eclectic label that ended up sort of recording the Goons albums. He worked with Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, all these kind of comedy songs of that era, really. So he spent a good few years producing comedy records.
And that, because to get from there to get into doing pop must have been a massive leap.
Yeah, well, by all accounts, he was trying to sort of break the label into sort of a rockier. He needed a band to get that rockier edge that he wanted to bring in and into the label. And he'd had a hit with other artists, but nobody that had really just sort of ignited. So this whole story of, I've got to tell you this story, because this, for me, obviously, you know, we love vinyl.
And do
we? Just slightly.
Vinyl?
Always have, though. I've never... we've never lost our love for vinyl.
No, we haven't, no.
Throughout our individual lives. We've always been...
I've always had a turntable.
So listen to this. Now, this, as I was doing some reading, it makes me really happy, actually. Because, you know, when Epstein, they went to Decca with the Beatles and they recorded an audition tape. And then they had the other band in at the time... Brian Poole and the Tremolos, and it was a toss-up between those two bands. And the head of Decca, who's called Dick Rowe...
Tremolos, another great band.
Exactly.
Because the 60s were full of these fantastic songs and fantastic bands.
It's no different today, though. There's lots of great musicians out there. Right. But what I do love is that Epstein decided that he was going to put the master tapes on record. So he went to HMV record store in Oxford Road, where he met engineer Jim Foy, because he wanted to have the tapes transferred to disc to make them easier to play for record producers. And it was Jim Foy who heard the tapes And he was really impressed, especially when he found out that three of the tracks were written by the band, that he suggested that they get a publishing deal to protect the copyright for their music.
No.
And it was Jim Foy at HMV who put him in contact with Sid Coleman of Ardmore.
Sid Vicious then?
No, Sid Coleman. Our man Sid, who was in a company, Ardmore and Beechwood, who happened to be a subsidiary of EMI. So Jim, the engineer at the record store, put him in contact with Sid, and that was a publishing label subsidiary of EMI.
Right. So did George Martin get involved then?
Well, because Sid rang George.
Right, Sid and George.
Yeah.
The comedy
it
duo.
It sounds a bit like another Peter Gabriel song again, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the main the thing is, if Brian Epstein hadn't wanted to put those tapes onto disc, he wouldn't have met Jim, and Jim wouldn't have given him the contact for Sid, the publisher, who then rang George Martin.
Well,
that's the connection. Vinyl.
That's fantastic.
The mighty vinyl.
And of course, it was easier because everybody had vinyl players then. But what a great idea. Yeah. See, Epstein was a genius, absolute genius manager. He really was. And another gentleman.
Yeah.
That's the thing. He was a gentleman. And so was George Martin. And even, I think that's where the Beatles got this little feel about them, that they were all quite a nice boys, and then the Rolling Stones were the ones that were all bad and crazy. I'm not quite exactly sure whether that was the case, because I think the Beatles were pretty hairy at times, there's no doubt about it. Anyway.
Indeed. So there's my little story.
Great. Next track.
I went into a dream.
day in the life. The Beatles.
A day in the life of a few Beatles, there. It's a magnificent song, isn't it? Incredible. Absolutely incredible track.
Yeah.
And it always, you know, I love that, the change between the first section and that second section. One written by Paul McCartney, one written, of course, by John Lennon.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about that track is that in the middle, they decided to put that huge string thing in there, that huge string cacophony. We'll talk about it a little bit more in the middle. But there was a guy called Mal Evans?
Mal Evans, yeah.
And Mal Evans was given the task of counting, because there was no click tracks here, boys. This is the, you know, this is the 60s. And there was no Pro Tools, no digital stuff. So he stood there and counted all the way through it and had an alarm clock to give him the exact time when it had to finish. How many seconds was it? 20?
24. It was 24 bars that he had to count.
24 bars, true. Yeah. So there was all this cacophony, so he had to count through it. So George Martin's up in the control room, the rest of the band are there, and, you know, and then they got the strings in later on.
They did. Well, and if you listen closely to that, the track, you can actually hear the alarm go off.
No.
And you can hear Mal counting 21, 22.
I'm going to have to listen to that again. That's incredible.
It is.
But again, Bleed, you see, and they left it in because actually there's nothing else they could do.
Oh, no.
You know, they were recording everything at the same, you know, they had a limited number of tracks, so they had to keep it in. Great.
Well, the whole thing was that they wanted this rhythm in the middle and they didn't necessarily know what to do. So Paul said he wanted a big symphony orchestra, and George was just going, you want a big symphony orchestra for that, like freaking out. And he's going, you know, actually, that let's be practical about it. He actually booked a 41-piece orchestra. And
well, that's pretty fucking big.
Yeah. And what he did is that he said, come on, let's just work out some harmonies. So he had to give some structure to the orchestra. And he basically gave everybody their bottom note and their top note and just said, it's a free-for-all. At this point, you've got to end at this note. And it was woodwind players, breathe when you feel like it. It was just complete and utter improvisation.
Blimey.
And they decided
that's like saying to Lemmy, drink when you feel like it, isn't it, really? I mean,
Well, apparently they wanted to make a big event of it as well. So he actually had to book the orchestra in evening dress.
No.
Oh, yeah, because Paul said, we're all dressing up, George. He said, you're not going to, obviously, it's not your kind of thing, because he's quite matter of fact and quite straight. And he sort of said, thanks. But he ended up wearing a Serrano de Bergerac nose during the recording. And there was one fiddle player that had a bear paw on. So they all, and Mick Jagger rocked up with Marianne Faithfull, and they had all these joss sticks. They just had a massive dress up party when they recorded it. Yeah.
When they were doing that section.
Yeah, when they were doing the orchestral
section.
Well,
there we go.
Isn't that fantastic?
But of course, it was the Beatles. And I mean, this time they were really rocking and rolling properly, weren't they? You know, they had money coming in from all sources. So.
Well, they were into experimenting, I suppose, weren't they?
Brilliant. But a great song. And you know, a little bit more about the recording there, you know. And what I do love about those two sections, they are completely distinctly different. I love also the vocal sound. He gets a great vocal sound on these, you know.
Mm.
And I do believe in those days they were using old AKG D12s. I may be wrong, but I think that's what they were using, which is like a dynamic mic rather than any condensers. Anyway, another, you know.
But that's the other role of the producer, isn't it? Is to sort of work with your artist.
Yeah. And again, you know, Jeff Emmerich, he was there sort of giving it plenty of stuff on those. Mm. You know, a genius. In fact, I'm going to order the book later on because it's apparently great, the Jeff Emmerich book. I haven't read it yet. Anyway.
Take a listen to this. And then fuse it with this. Thank you. Time Beat by Ray Cathode.
Yeah.
AKA George Martin.
Yes. The Tube. Cathode Tube, anyway.
See? Yeah,
many years for the Tube, but not many years before the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, because this all came out of all that thing, didn't it?
Yeah. Apparently, they had the BBC had this sort of avant-garde den of malevolence where they call it a mad scientist lab for new sound effects. And there was a lady called Maddalena Fagandini. I don't know how to pronounce it. Maddalena Fagandini?
Well, I'm glad you pronounce it, not me.
She's Italian and an electronic musician. Well, I don't think
she's going to be for Accrington like Fagandini.
Very funny. Well, she was an electronic musician in those days. I think it's fantastic. Go girl. And she used to produce these interval signals. And what they were... where they were assigned to identify breaks in international programmes.
No.
Yeah, so usually played before the start or during breaks in transmission. It was like a station identifier. So they took this sound of the time
and
experimented with it.
And George Martin took this one of these interval things and then made that track.
Yeah, they put like a jazzy waltz on top of it with one of her signals.
Right.
Cool. So that's what the first sound was, an interval signal.
Right, okay. And of course, Delia Derbyshire, not Delia Smith, but she was a cook, of course, and
yeah.
Delia Derbyshire was a cook of music. But she became very, very, very famous because I think she did the Doctor Who theme, but Doctor Who came quite a bit after this, didn't it?
A couple of years after that, really.
Wow, incredible.
I wonder if they wore white coats.
Oh, they definitely wore white coats. The BBC were all in white coats in the 60s, weren't they? You know, like it really, what does upset me, and it really does upset me, is what's happened to the BBC in terms of all the cuts and all that sort of carry on. Because, you know, in the 60s and 50s, and you know, they were, well, since they started, they were total innovators. And they used public money for good use. They actually researched. All the stuff is published. All the research is published. It's free to download. I mean, our acoustic panels in the studio were designed by the BBC, and all we've done is we've just had them built as per their designs.
Yeah.
And they sound fantastic. You know, it makes the studio sound fantastic. You know, they're in the right places, of course, but they're amazing. And all this is being lost, you know. This research into sound and all that beautiful experimentation, and it's all gone.
Well, they were saying as well that track was sort of almost predating electronic music in the 90s. It was like three decades ahead of its time, really, because you can sort of hear influences of the Aphex Twins there. And I mean, I totally hear what you're saying.
Well, I know for a fact that Mary Epworth and Will Twynham, when they hear the show, will go, wow, yes, we like this.
Yeah.
In fact, they'll know about it already because they're really cool, those guys. But
they've probably got an interval machine in there that they're...
Yeah, they're probably cranking it out.
Mary going, oh, I've got this. How does this work? Yeah. Let's do this, because she's always posting photos of new gadgets and things.
Yeah, that's right.
I love that about those two. They're
very... Yeah, they're very creative, yeah.
Yeah, got great energy.
Yeah, he's got a moustache as well, and a black eye at the moment, I believe, as well. Anyway.
Remember, we saw them at the Castle. Brilliant gig in Manchester.
Yeah,
and it's lovely to meet people who are beautiful as well, well as producing beautiful music. They're beautiful people.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Bit of a plug there. So if you don't know Mary Epworth and Will Twynham, look up on the internet. We got a vinyl of theirs as well, beautiful, of the last album. It was really great. Anyway.
Yeah, so we've got BBC, Sir George Martin, experimentation, interval signals.
All good.
Fantastic, George.
But the question is, how did he get here?
Thank you. left me sad and lonely. Why did you leave me lonely? 'Cause here's a heart that's only for nobody but you. I'm burning like a flame, dear. I'll never be the same, dear. I'll always place the blame, dear, on nobody but you. You, you're driving me crazy. What did I do? Oh, what did I do? My tears for you make everything easy. Clouding a sky of blue. How true were the friends who were near me to cheer me, believe me, they knew that you were the kind who would hurt me, desert me when I needed you. You, you're driving me crazy. What did I do to you?
Driving Me Crazy by The Temperance Seven.
A number one single, that.
In what year?
1961. So this is predating everything. You know, all the pop music and everything. So this is a number one single then.
It sounds great.
It does. It sounds like it was recorded yesterday. In fact, when I was looking for this track, I had to check it wasn't a modern recording of it. It sounds really fucking good. You know, well, it's George Martin, of course. He produced it, which so you'd expect it to sound good. But you know, it's incredible, and they were probably using old ribbon mics and stuff. But it's just natural, and it's in your face, and not a lot of reverb. There's beautiful present sound. It just sounds like they're in the room with you. It's great.
It's like a musical comedy, isn't it? You can hear it all in the music. It is quite fun.
Well, it's the tuba that does it. Yeah. It always makes me laugh, the tuba. And that's what I love about that, the band album, you know, the Brown album, the band, because they got that, you know, they replaced the bass guitar quite a bit with the tuba, and it's great. But this, you know, great song. Very, you know, it's sort of really... The vocals great. It's I just love it.
Well, apparently, all I know about them is that they were formed from students from the Chelsea School of Art, and they're called the Temperance Seven, but there were actually nine of them.
Ah, like the Alabama Three.
See,
because there were a whole fucking load of Alabama Threes, aren't there?
Yeah,
very confusing.
So really, from what I can understand as well, is like this is kind of it was a means to an end as well. You know, he enjoyed. Doing comedy and sort of eclectic recordings, but you could tell that later on George was on this road. He wanted to get a different style into the label, really. But what he did very well. But I think he was looking for that elusive band to sort of crack it. Like
I think
said.
He found it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But it's incredible.
Jerry and the Pacemakers. Well, yeah, but I mean, you know.
Yeah.
We can't at all decry any Jerry and the Pacemakers stuff because they wrote massive songs, you know. The Beatles just did more of it. I think that's the, you know, that's the whole...
I mean, the thing is as well, I mean, with, I think with his instrumentation, he is big on strings, but it's the drama, it's the feel, it's the vibe that he was after creating, and he knew how to do that with classical instruments. And fusing those two together, I think, was quite innovative of the time, really.
Well, that's quite... I mean, when you listen to that, it was obviously recorded all at the same time. They'd done a few takes of it, and that was during the days. In 1961, they were probably just going straight to acetate, so they were probably cutting the, you know, cutting the record as they were actually recording it. I don't know, I'm not sure about this particular recording, but it was very common in those days. You'd get them in, cut it right to the actual metal.
Yeah, quick turnaround.
That's right, and that's it, done.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, George has worked with so many different people, and so it's odd because you could just, he's just always on the lookout. He's always working with people. Yeah. But I think what it was is, well, that if he got on with them, that was fine. If he didn't get on with them, there was no point working with them, because if your personalities don't connect, you're not going to get a good result.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing, and this morning we were looking through a lot of the tracks that he has done with other people, other acts, and quite honestly, we didn't really get a lot of it. I mean, he worked with America, he worked with, that's the band America, you know, he's worked with loads and loads of artists, but we really struggled to find something that was amazing other than the stuff that we've played today, which I think, I mean, every track we've played today has been amazing.
Yeah.
But it was, it's odd, I think the Beatles must have really just consumed him totally, and I think possibly drained him a lot of his creative energy, you know?
Well, after the first album, I think he actually released an orchestral album of Beatles songs.
Mm.
And it didn't sell. It's now a collector's item. It just didn't connect, you know, because it's almost like he was trying to almost get... Here's a question. Was it the melodies that he wanted to sort of connect to with it in a classical way for him to, because he's done, he did another album, The Beatles for Girls or something.
Did he?
It was all about, another orchestral album of Beatles songs about Eleanor Rigby, you know, all the girl songs. And it just didn't connect because I guess everyone had the Beatles. Why would they want an orchestral kind of more James Last feel? For me, that would feel next to the Beatles. If I heard the Beatles songs in orchestral format, I would think James Last.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of cheesy in a way, you know?
Yeah, and I think, though, that he still wanted to do that because that was in him.
Mm.
I mean, it's hard because in some ways he totally connected with working with the guys, you know?
Yeah, well, and Jeff Beck and Jerry the Pacemakers and these guys,
certain
you
people.
Know, a Temperance Seven and many other.
I mean, there were other artists as well that you'll never really know. It's like I read something about he was in on a recording with when Cilla Black was doing Elfie with a massive orchestra, and the conductor was just over and over again, like 30 takes, again, and she was almost like on her knees, and he just said, "No, you got the take, like the third take or three takes ago," and it was like, so they were saying
he worked with Cilla Black a lot,
didn't
he?
Yeah, but it's just those things, you know, you can overdo it, keep going, and so, but he's not credited with that. It's just in a story that that he gave in an interview, or that Cilla gave, that I think he was just this big. I mean, I actually saw George in 92 because he
did you actually meet him or just see him?
No, my friend met him. I actually didn't want to meet him, but he was there. He was given an honorary award because they just got this new degree in popular music and recording, and I was there representing the medium production, medium performance class, because they just passed the degree. And he was very tall and a gentleman and had a very calm nature.
Mm.
See, I'm not really interested in meeting people with a profile unless we can sit down and have a good old chat.
I never know what to say to them anyway.
No.
I've met loads of people. I'll go up to them and I just go, and this is me. I mean, I speak for fuck, I can talk for England, you know, but when you meet, what do you say to them?
Well,
oh, Stevie, you know, Stevie Wonder, I love your work. You know, how many people said that to him? You just stand there and just you really need to get into them. And you're right, you need to go out to dinner with them and just sit and listen to them for a bit, and then you can start getting breaking down.
Yeah, they've got to
questions.
Know you exist, and they actually want to ask you a question. If they don't, I don't see the point of shaking someone's hand going, hi.
Yeah. Because it's Stevie Wonder or George Martin or anybody or Paul McCartney and say, and what do you do, Simon? Well, I'm a guitar player, I'm a composer, I'm an engineering producer. Oh, what have you done? And you sort of, yes, I have done stuff, but compared with them, I mean, it's like a pimple
it's
on
like,
the arse of the universe. That's right. It's ridiculous. So why do they want to speak to me? I don't know. You know?
But, I mean, I leave it to life and the adventure and who you meet organically as well. I mean, sometimes you've got to push a door if you want to. And I think you have to do that because... Go on.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. If this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.
Incredible. It jumps out the speakers and beats you with it like a club. It's fantastic.
I love that.
Another Bond theme. Another Bond theme.
Exactly. And the reggae section was written by Linda McCartney.
Is that right?
Go girl.
You know, all the shit about Linda McCartney, I know we're talking about George Martin today, but it does irritate me. They fell in love. He wanted her to be with him all times in the band and everything. And Yoko had done the same with John Lennon. Exactly the same sort of situation. But she got stuck in. She learned to play. She was a fantastic photographer, you know. She's a world-class photographer, well-known. And she learned to play. And she started singing. And then she started writing fucking music.
Yeah.
It was, you know, Yeah, I've got to take my hat off to her. If I had one on, I'd take it off. So there we are, Linda. I think you did a great fucking job there, girl.
Yeah, indeed.
But back to this production.
Yeah, well, John Barry wasn't available, so they asked Paul McCartney to write it, and they got our mate George in.
I think George is just getting his own back for what he did with Goldfinger, because he came in, as we heard earlier on the show, and took over from George Martin, arranging it, or like coming in the big I am. I'm John Barry, and I'm going to produce Goldfinger and all that. Of course, and this one, I think he was getting his own back. Oh. Fuck you, John. I think that's what he's—that's what he was saying in his gentleman way, of course.
Well, I love this. One of the producers' surnames, Broccoli.
I know. Yeah, come, yeah, the Broccolis.
Yeah. And Saltzman, the producers, they planned to have somebody else sing the song, you know, after Paul and Linda had written "Live and Let Die," and so story has it that George got them into Air, and they recorded the song in. With a full orchestra, got the song completed. He dashed out to the Caribbean where they were on location filming, got a record player, played it for them, and they turned around and said, oh, that's a nice demo. He said, no, this is it. No, we want, I think it was Thelma Houston or someone to sing it.
Who the fuck's Thelma Houston? Now, somebody's going to say it.
I do know Thelma Houston. I have heard of her.
I've never heard of her.
Yeah, I think what they wanted was a Thelma big, Louise, big yes. sort of, you know, bluesy voice type, powerful, bassy-esque. It's a difficult word to say
it
that.
Is, yeah.
So, but the thing is, this is where George insisted. He would not let them do that. He said, no, this will work. And they finally agreed that they were going to use that song, and it topped the charts in the USA. Yippee!
Yeah.
Number 9 in the UK singles charts for 14 weeks it was in the charts.
Well, it's a great song.
Go George!
I always remember it because it was the one incarnation of Bond, which I don't particularly like. Who was it who actually played? Roger Moore. That's right. It was when you look back, his suits and all that thing. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't great, and I didn't really like it. The film is good though, because
it's an iconic industry, isn't it? It's part of our heritage, James Bond, really.
Yeah, totally. And we've had two Bond massive themes in this show, produced by the legendary Sir George Martin.
So you could almost say that he, you know, go Martin your broccoli type thing, as in a phrase for don't take no for an answer.
Indeed.
Not that it really, yeah, but the thing that I understand from George is that he was gentle, honest. He was a very honest guy, you know. He could have easily got another writer credit on the Beatles stuff for any time, you know, with any of his artists, because that's what they used to do in those days.
Yeah,
and he didn't. And he got them a better deal because they didn't really get a fantastic contract. And I think that he's the epitome.
It's the Beatles are talking about.
Yeah, and George in general, from what I've read about him and people that have given tributes since he died, and just I think what it is that I wanted to get a sense of the gentleman, you know, and the man. And, you know, you've got to have some go about you. You've got to have something. You know, you say, well, he's a really good guy, a really kind guy. But you've got to have some balls of steel too,
well,
you know. Cause
dealing with the Beatles for all those years and doing all those records, they would not have had him involved if he wasn't absolutely, totally central to the process of them recording those records. I mean, the engineers are all there. Emmerich and all these guys, you know, great engineers, but he was the man, and they must have really trusted him. And, you know, we haven't played a lot of Beatles today because we wanted to do something a little bit different, but...
Well, I think there are plenty of other sources
Yeah.
And it's a sense that, you know, well, what else has he done? Because I know that there was a frustration for a long time, you know, after he finished working with them. You know, it's like he's got his own identity, before and subsequently, you know?
Well, totally.
And he was one of the first guys to go independent as well, because he got such a shit salary at EMI that he just, you know, it wasn't worth his... It was ridiculous. So that's why he started Independent Air, you know, so that he could
actually... Well, he left us with that studio, which is one of the greatest orchestral studios in the world, you know, Air Studio. So thanks, George, for that. thanks for all your productions. Thanks for all the music you've helped to bring to the planet.
And they say that even though Martin twisted a lot of knobs and wrote a lot of faders, he fostered something less tangible. They call it something like a feeling or a vibe or whatever you call it. It's something that you can't really
define.
And he said of Tomorrow Never Knows as well, he said, we made that record. We could never reproduce it again.
Mm.
And I think that's what he gave.
Well, but all the producers that we've featured so far, we've had Lanois, we've had Glyn Johns, we've now got, George Martin, and we're going to carry on. We're going to do a few more because we're really into this. They've all got the same thing. They're all recording people together. They all add something to the process by inspiring and motivating the musicians to greatness. They're all trusted and respected by the people that they work for.
The ego's left at the door.
That's right. And up to now, everyone that we've looked at has been a musician. Interesting, isn't it? And a good musician at that. We've had classical, we've had bluesy, rocky, we've had Glyn Johns, who started off playing guitar and singing and writing his own stuff,
Yeah.
All of them are musicians. Anyway, so that's the end of the show for today.
That's a good thought there, darling.
Mm. And it's, well, thank you. And if you have any comments, please contact us on our email, which is podcast@supertonerecords.com.
We'd love to hear from you because obviously this is for you, and it'd be great to know what you enjoy as well. And any other sort of topic suggestions would be great too. I mean, as you say, we're going to do some more producer ones. We're actually really enjoying it.
Yeah, we are. They're really good, these.
There's so much information sometimes you can get a bit tongue-twisted because it's sort of on fire with all this
information. That's right.
But the main thing is it's all because we want to try and understand how we make great music.
Yeah, absolutely. Twitter is Susie and Simon.
S-U-Z-Y.
Yeah, the Z for you Americans out there.
Sí.
So, see you next time. Hasta luego.
Gracias. Luego.
Supertone.